Now the pattern of Quimper living became clear. On bright autumn days, Jubal and Yancey would search out the pecan trees, shake the branches, and garner the fallen nuts so rich in foodstuff. Hauling them home like conquering heroes who had risked much to catch their prey, they would toss the nuts toward where Matty waited. "Matt, old girl, we did it again," Jubal would shout, and then retire, highly pleased with himself, while his wife built a fire, heated water, and dipped the pecans to soften the shell and moisten the nut meat to make it easier to extract. While her husband watched approvingly, she cracked the shells, sharpened a fine-pointed stick, and made Yancey use it to dig out the meats, which she dried on a flat stone beside the fire. When he had extracted huge quantities, warned constantly by Jubal, "Don't break them, Yancey," Matty prepared her hoard in one of three ways. Folks like 'em just toasted, or better if we can find a smidgen of salt, or best of all if I coat 'em in honey real thick with just a touch of salt. Often when travelers stopped, the men would gorge on handfuls of Matty's pecans as they played cards, almost fighting for the toasted nuts if they were the honeyed version. Jubal always explained the trouble he'd had in finding the trees, watching them through the ripening seasons and dragging home the garnered hoard. "Yancey breaks a lot of the halves," he apologized. "It's a pity, but Matty's real good at toasting them and adding the honey." The Quimpers were proving that, properly handled, this nut provided one of the world's complete sources of food. Yancey was not fond of pecans. Too much work. Now, if a family had slaves to do the picking, that would be something. Management of the ferry was arranged slowly and without conscious decision. Jubal had built it, and in the early days had operated it. Not effectively. He did nothing effective but hunt, play cards, and find pecans, but with enough skill to earn a few coins. However, when more travelers began coming their way, he found himself occupied with gathering meat during the day and gaming with the visitors at night, which meant that he was often too busy to man the ferry. "Matty, old girl, I hear a stranger calling. Can you go fetch him?" So she would interrupt whatever she was doing, go down the steep incline to where the ferry waited, and with increasing ability, pole it across the Brazos to pick up the traveler. In time, she began to think of it as her ferry, and to resent it if either her husband or her son, each stronger than she, interfered with her operation. For from it, she accumulated small sums of money, which she set aside to speed the day when she could have a real house. The Quimpers had occupied their dwelling about 7 months when the owner of their land, Stephen Austin, came up the Brazos to regularize their holding. And as soon as they saw him, they liked him. He was an intense, smallish man in his late 20s, with a sharp face and gentle eyes. He spoke softly, was greatly interested in the progress of the ferry, and amused by the way the Quimpers had marked out their land. When he saw their corner stakes, he burst into laughter. "You rascals! Stretching your land along the river, preempting the good frontage. Don't you know the law of all nations?" "What are you talking about?" Quimper asked, almost belligerently. He was 4 years older than Austin, and much heftier. Austin laughed and clapped him on the shoulder. "Let's have a drink," he said. And when Matty came with a weak but sweet wine they had made from their muscadines, he explained, "From the time of Hammurabi, in all orderly societies, governments have told their people, 'Sure, you want land. But at the river, the frontage on the water can be only a small percentage of the depth of the field. You cannot own a long, narrow strip which prevents others from reaching the river.'" "What percentage?" Jubal asked. And he said, "The customary Spanish grant along the Rio Grande has been 9/13 of a mile facing the river, 11 to 13 miles back from the river." "Outrageous," Matty exploded. "That's a sliver, not a field." I agree, Austin said. Up here we allow a square. And using a stick in the dust, he sketched a more legal claim. He was also amused to find that the Quimpers had staked out a rather large chunk of land on the opposite side of the Brazos, where their ferry landed. And he told them, My father taught me to oppose that. No man shall own both sides of a river. If Mexico City ever lets us have our own legislature, I'll sponsor a law saying so. Our ferry has to land somewhere. But you can't own both sides of the river. That would tempt you, in time of trouble, to close down the river. What can we do? Keep your dock over there. Keep your road up to higher ground, and even build a small warehouse if you wish. I'll certify to the Mexican government it was necessary for public convenience. Austin stayed with them for 2 weeks, paying liberally for his lodging. And in this time they had an opportunity to assess his character. He was straightforward, pedantic, stern in protection of what he viewed as his rights, and a loyal Mexican citizen. I have surrendered all thoughts of ever returning to the United States. We have an honorable government in Texas, and under its protection we can live in dignity and security. They did not learn then or ever whether Austin was a true convert to Catholicism or not. Some travelers insisted that he had been a stout Catholic back in Missouri. Others that they knew people there who had seen him attending a Protestant church. It was definite that he had claimed Catholic membership when seeking permission to assume the huge grant which his father had acquired shortly before his death. And certainly the Mexican government considered him a loyal Catholic. This interpretation was strengthened when Austin spoke highly of Father Clooney. When sober, he's a devout man of God, and we're lucky to have him in our colony. But the religious problem became more complicated in the early months of 1824, when Joel Job Harrison came south from his cabin on the Trinity to organize his clandestine Methodist services. He took lodging with the Quimpers and convened his first study group at their makeshift inn, a gathering of 9 families who had converted in order to get land, but whose secret sympathies were still strongly Protestant. At their first meeting up north, Quimper had not liked Harrison, for he had recognized the tall, angular man as the kind of fanatic who plunged his friends into trouble, and the man's frenzied words had strengthened this adverse impression. But now, when he saw Harrison engaged in his pastoral work, and watched the compassion with which the Methodist greeted these lonely souls along the frontier, he had to admit that the gawky preacher was a man of God, as simple and honorable in his way as Father Clooney was in his, and as eloquent. It is our holy mission here in the remote woods of Texas to keep alive the sacred fire of Protestant vision. Surely, it is the destiny of this great land of Texas to be like the rest of the United States, a haven of Protestant decency and security. We are Methodists, and it is our duty to preserve our faith and keep it strong for those who follow. How shameful they will see us to have been if we allow our sacred faith, the noblest possession a man can have, to wither. Friends, I implore you, be of stout heart, and soon we shall see our churches flourish openly in this wilderness. We are the beginners, the sowers of seed, the keepers of the sacred flame. He made the simple act of gathering for quiet worship, away from the watchful eyes of the Mexican authorities, an affirmation of religious and political principle, and he implied that any who did not participate were morally defunct and not worthy of the exalted name of Protestant or Texan, for he identified one with the other. He was incapable of believing that a real Texan could be a Catholic, and although he never preached his treason openly, he also doubted that a Texan could be a true citizen of Mexico. When Quimper asked him about this, Harrison explained, "I'm sure that what you say is true. Of course Austin pays homage to Mexico. He must. Otherwise he loses his land. And I'm sure he wants the public to consider him a Catholic, for this confirms his ownership. But in his heart, what is he? I'll give you my right hand up to the elbow if Austin is not an American patriot waiting to take Texas into the Union, and a loyal Protestant just waiting to open our churches in this colony and in the rest of Texas." The two men left it there, with Harrison convinced that the Quimpers were still faithful Methodists, prepared to summon their fellow religionists to prayer sessions whenever he had an opportunity to visit his Brazos territory. "I suppose in my heart I'll always be a Methodist," Jubal told his wife when Harrison returned north. "But I don't like worshiping in secret, especially when it could get us into trouble." One evening, as the pair sat and watched deer graze beneath the far oaks, Jubal asked, "Matty, do you consider yourself a Mexican citizen?" She pondered this, then said, "I never considered myself a Tennessee citizen. I get up in the morning, do my work, and go to bed." "But could you be a Mexican? Are you going to learn Spanish?" "Enough people come through here speaking it, I'll have to." "Well, are you a Catholic?" She evaded a direct answer. "Two of the best men I've met are Father Clooney and Reverend Harrison. I like them both." "But you have to choose sides." "Why?" And she displayed no interest in which side he had chosen. The question of Mexican citizenship became more pressing when a guest reached the ferry to stay at the Cave House while trying to round up extra mules to drive overland to New Orleans. In halting English, he gave his name as Benito Garza, said he was 18 years old, and a native of the little town of Bravo down on the Rio Grande. "I cross Rivera," he called it Rivera, "and catch the mule. You know what it is, the mule? Father a jackass, mother a horse. The mule all gunpowder and fury. But I tame the mule." "We know all about mules in Tennessee," Jubal interrupted. "But you're not going to take those 17 mules all the way to New Orleans alone?" "Oh, no. At the Trinity, I meet Mr. Ford. He got 50 mules, 60 from San Antonio. We take them together." The Quimpers liked Garza, for the young man was so enthusiastic that his ebullience became infectious. "Mr. Ford, fine man. He give me money. I get him mules in Mexico. Maybe I buy 4, 5 more right here?" The Quimpers knew of no farmers in the vicinity who might have bred mules, but they promised young Garza to watch his while he scouted the river. And on the next day, the irrepressible young man reappeared with 4 good animals. "I always find them somewhere." During the young muleteer's last night at the inn, Matty could not control her curiosity. "Your mother? What'd she think about such a trip? To New Orleans?" "She's dead, but I go on trail first time 12 years old." 12? "She tell me, you got to learn when you young." "Where's your home?" "Rio Grande. Lots of land. Lots of children, too. Brothers get land. I get mules." Despite her inclination to be impartial in most things, she could not help comparing this adventurous Mexican with her timorous son. "Weren't you afraid, 12 years old?" "No," he said brightly. "Men all alike, Mexican, Texican. You quick, you got a little money, is all right." "What was your mother like?" Matty asked as she passed her salted pecans. most beautiful girl in San Antonio. Everybody said so. Frenchmen wanted to marry her, American too. But she walked to Rio Grande to marry my father. 9 children. Wonderful love story. And what will you do? Make much money New Orleans, then help my sisters find husbands. When the young fellow headed up the trail with his 21 mules, Jubal said, "He's the best visitor we've had since Father Clooney left." Then he added, "I think I'll learn Spanish serious." When he caught the rhythm of that beautiful language, probably the easiest on earth for a stranger to learn, he told his wife, "When I had to argue with that Ripper Da at Nacogdoches, I wanted nothing to do with Mexicans. But now that I see this land and a fine young man like Garza, I'm beginning to think that Mexico is where we'll spend our years." She replied, "Texas, Tennessee, they all seem the same. Catholic, Protestant, likewise." "But you said you respected Reverend Harrison." "I respect Father Clooney, but that don't make me a Catholic." At times, Jubal could not understand his thin, secretive wife. Her indifference to some things mystified him. She could work interminably without complaint. She ran the ferry, and certainly it was she who kept the inn functioning. But she always came back to her two obsessions. "Jubal, I won't live in this cave house much longer." And, "Jubal, we got to get hold of that land on the other end of the ferry." To the first demand, her husband temporized. "As soon as we get ahead, I'll build you a real house." And to the second, he reasoned, "You heard Austin say you can't control land on both sides of the river?" And she asked bluntly, "Does Austin need to know?" And sometimes, when the ferry was waiting on the far side of the river, Jubal would see his wife marching about the land, driving stakes to mark what she wanted. She was doing this one day when the Carrancawa struck, and only by rushing down to the river and jumping onto the raft as it slid away from the shore did she escape being killed. The Indians raged along the bank, then disappeared into the wood on that side, rampaging far toward isolated cabins, where they killed the inhabitants. The response was powerful. A contingent of 30 well-armed men marched down to the new headquarters settlement of San Felipe, where they joined with settlers from the coast in a 10-day campaign against the Kronks. When the Brazos River men straggled back to the ferry, they told Matty wondrous tales about their battles. "We overtook them in their camp. 10 of us up here, 10 over here, 10 making the attack. Crossed-fired them till they had to accept a truce." "Was Yancey in the fight?" Matty asked. "No, he watched the horses." "Not right for a boy to be killing folks." "He'd better kill Indians, or they're going to kill him." There was a strange outcome to this inconclusive battle. One morning, when Matty had guided the ferry to the far bank, depositing 2 travelers headed for Nacogdoches, she heard a rustling in the woods, and saw, to her horror, that a very tall Carrancawa was hiding there, armed with an old-fashioned gun. Unable to reach the ferry as before, she reached for some stick with which to defend herself. But the big Indian put down his weapon and came forward with hands outstretched. Because Matty had always been willing to accept as her brother any honest man she encountered, she felt no hesitancy in dropping her stick and holding forth her hands. And thus began a strange friendship with a brave the Quimpers called the Kronk. He lived in a self-made hut beside the inn, and when he had learned a few words of English, he explained, with the help of vigorous signs, that the men of his family had led the sortie against the Brazos cabins and had been practically eliminated in the retaliation. "Sun goes down. Carrancawa no more." He spoke with great sorrow of the deplorable time in which he lived. White man too strong, he break us. He made a snapping sound with his fingers, like twigs being shattered. He was capable of real grief, as when he spoke of his women slain in the last battle. Babies they best, always hope, babies grow. He liked Yancey, who was terrified of him, and longed to teach the boy those things fathers teach their sons. But young Quimper drew away, and one night Mattie was appalled when her son said, "If a new battle starts, the men will kill Kronk for sure." When Mattie upbraided him for the insensitivity she perceived, Yancey replied, "He's an Indian, ain't he?" And the conversation ended. The Kronk was so helpful around the cave house that Jubal said one morning, "Mattie, I think that with Kronk's help we might could build you a set of real outside walls for this dugout." But she snapped, "I don't want no improvements. I want a real house with four walls around." And he laughed, "We ain't that ambitious." With great effort, Jubal, the Kronk, and Yancey chopped out some stout lengths to substitute for the vertical poles that had framed their cabin. And slowly, finishing one side after another, they inserted the heavy logs, converting their flimsy-walled cave house into a sturdy one. Travelers familiar with the former stopping place congratulated them on the improvement, but invariably the Quimpers confessed, "We couldn't have done it without the Kronk." Strangers who had often been required to fight the Indians were sometimes startled to find a real Karankawa living at the ferry. But those who settled in the area grew accustomed to the bronze giant with the flashing white teeth. They often found him sitting with Mattie, talking in his strange way with words which only she seemed to understand. She was not afraid to ask him anything, and one afternoon she said bluntly, "Why do you Kronks eat people?" And he explained, with grunts and gestures and the few words he knew, that it was not done from hunger, but as a ritual, confirming victory in battle, or as a source of valor, as when warriors ate the heart, liver, and tongue of a gallant adversary. "But you did eat them," she asked. And he replied, "Good, like turkey." He became a kind of unpaid servant at the inn. But in return for his help, he did receive food and such clothing as he wanted and the Quimpers were able to provide. His chief contribution was as a hunter, and under Jubal's tutelage he learned to be as parsimonious with his powder and lead as Quimper himself. With a fine hunter like the Kronk available, Jubal no longer took Yancey with him, for the boy was useless in the field. The Kronk was a skilled shot, and with his gun, which his tribe had purchased from French traders in the early years of the century, he could knock down a buffalo or trail a deer almost as well as Jubal himself. As a pair, they were formidable, and travelers grew accustomed to having copious helpings of meat when they visited Quimper's Inn. Once, when he returned with three slain deer, Mattie asked, "Why do you shoot so many deer, so few turkey?" And he explained, "Deer easy, turkey damn hard." When she asked the difference, he said, "Kronk sneak up, deer see. They think, is Kronk or tree stump? And they stand there. I shoot. But when Kronk sneak up on turkey, leader cry, by God, Kronk coming, and off they go. Kronk never see him again." Often in the long months of that first year, before Mattie's corn had ripened or the crops matured, meat was all they had had. Months would pass without flour for the making of bread. Salt was scarce. Vegetables did not yet exist. And men would say, "Last night I dreamed of fresh bread, covered with butter and sprinkled with salt. God, how I hate venison." But when they had Jubal's honey to flavor the great chunks of roasted meat, the frontiersmen stopped complaining. It's uncanny how Jubal can smell out a honey tree 3 miles away, they said. But others said, he's just as good at tracking bear. When Maddie smokes it properly, you can't tell it from Pennsylvania bacon. But what Jubal really enjoyed was stalking the wild turkey. For as he told the others, salt or no salt, bread or no bread, that bird is delicious. Once a wandering Irishman named Mulrooney brought the Quimpers a bundle containing real flour, about 3 pounds, which he had acquired at great cost from an incoming vessel at the mouth of the Brazos. "Could you make me some bread? I'm starving for bread." Mattie said that she could if he'd let her keep some slices, because I'm starving for bread, too. But when he saw that she was preparing to mix a dough using most of his flour, he protested. No, ma'am, no. And he told her that in backwoods Tejas they used half flour, half acorn, and he proceeded to take Yancey with him to gather the latter. No, not that kind, Mulrooney said. Them's red oaks, very high in tannic acid, burn your gut. What he sought were the fat, beautiful acorns of the live oak, a variety whose nuts were reassuringly deficient in tannin. The numerous but tiny acorns of the post oak he ignored completely. Waste of time, not enough meat. When he and Yancey had a bag full of the rich-looking nuts, he peeled them and asked for a bucket of scalding water, in which he boiled them for 3 hours. We're driving out the acid. Now, when that's done, we boil them again for 3 hours in very salty water. Sweetens them up. The two boilings took most of a day, but that night he spread the blanched acorns before the fire so that they might be crushed and pulverized at dawn. When this was done, he had a fine white flour, almost indistinguishable from the bought variety. And from this mix, Mattie made her bread. By God, that's good, Mulrooney exclaimed when his first piece was smeared with honey. You know, Miss Mattie, you and me could make a fortune with this here bread. And the Quimpers agreed that it was palatable. It was more than that. It's damn good, Jubal said. And he told Mattie, remember how he did it. Stay away from them red oaks. On a summer day in 1824, as Mattie poled her ferry across the Brazos, she saw well to the west a phenomenon which did not startle her, but which did attract her attention. As she explained later, I thought nothing of it at first, dark clouds along the horizon. But after a while, I realized they were darker than any I'd seen before. And they didn't move like an ordinary storm, just hung there like a distant curtain. While the darkness intensified without any visible motion, she deposited her passenger on the far shore. Mister, something strange. I'd watch for cover. What do you think it is? The man asked. And she said, I don't rightly know, but some place back there is catching rain, and if they're getting it now, we'll get it soon. When she returned to her own side of the river, she called for Jubal, but he was off tracking honeybees, so she spent a few minutes outside studying the storm. Yancey, come here and see this cloud. When the boy stood with her, she repeated, somebody upriver's catching a lot of rain. And soon thereafter, Jubal came running home with news that the river was rising. For most of that long summer day, the tremendous black clouds remained motionless along the northwestern horizon, depositing enormous quantities of rain, so that as dusk approached, the Brazos showed a sullen rise of nearly a foot. Jubal said, if it starts to rain here, Mattie, that river could really run wild. When the first drops did come splattering down just at nightfall, Mattie told her men, I think I'll stay with the ferry, in case. And by the time she poled it across the river to the more protected anchoring place on the opposite shore, the rain was falling not in drops, but in torrents. and she realized that it was bound to lift the river level so drastically that she would have to remain there through the night and away from the turbulent center of the rampaging river. She was drenched. Hair, eyes, clothes, hands, all were soaked in the lashing rain. From time to time, as she pulled away from the uncontrolled flood, she became aware that great trees, uprooted from the northwest, were moving down the current, and these she must avoid. "Will the cabin survive?" she asked herself toward dawn, when it became apparent that this was to be a historic flood, far in excess of any whose remnants Jubal had pointed out to her on that first day. "Pray God it doesn't reach our hill." In its outer reaches, of course, the great flood was not a swift-moving body of water. It was a quiet intrusion, sometimes hardly moving at all. But remorselessly it submerged everything. Only at the center of the riverbed did the waters form a foaming, rampaging, irresistible torrent. 50 miles to the south, where the distance between the Brazos and the Colorado narrowed to a corridor, the flood became so tremendous that the backwaters from the two rivers actually joined in a great sweeping ocean. At Quimper's Ferry, the flood rose so high, it drove Mattie 3 miles inland before she managed to tie her craft to the branches of an oak whose trunk was 7 feet underwater. There she remained for 2 cold days, until she saw that the waters were beginning to recede. Whereupon she poled across fields to where the ferry was customarily tied. And as the waters swiftly dropped, she crossed the Brazos and brought her craft home. "We thought you was dead," her husband said, matter-of-factly, as she climbed up to her rain-soaked cabin. And she told him, "I thought I was too, but God helped with the pole." She looked at their undamaged home, then kissed her husband. "Thank God, Jubal, you made us build up here." Yancey broke in. "When the flood came 3 feet up the wall, we thought we was done. But the crunk led Pop and me to that grove of oaks and tied ourselves in a tree." Jubal hushed him. "We was all lucky, and for that we can thank God. I wish Father Clooney was here to lead us in prayer." And for the next 100 years, people along the Brazos would remember it as the year the Brazos ran wild, or the year the rivers joined. Mattie recalled it as the year I lost my corn. The Quimpers were less lucky with another event caused by the flood, and this too would be remembered. The excessive waters disturbed many animals, causing them to venture into new areas and adopt new habits. And one of those most seriously displaced was a huge rattlesnake, 8 feet 3 inches long from the tip of its rattle, and as big around as a small tree. He was really a monstrous creature, with a head as big as a soup plate, and fangs so huge and powerful they could discharge a dreadful injection. Veteran of many struggles, master of the sudden ambush, he had subdued baby pigs and fawns and rabbits and a multitude of rats and mice. His traditional home had been 16 miles up the Brazos, in a rocky ledge that gave him excellent protection and a steady supply of victims. But the floods had dislodged him and sent him tumbling down the river, along with deer and alligators and javelinas. During the height of the flood, each animal was so preoccupied with its own salvation that it ignored friends and enemies alike. But as the waters receded, each resumed its habits, and the snake found itself far downstream, lodged in unfamiliar rocks, and with a most uncertain food supply. The rattler now had to be more venturesome than usual, and began foraging far from its crevice. Sometimes it went down close to the river, exploring the rocks there, and on other days it slithered inland, watching always to be sure that it had adequate cover to protect it from the blazing sun, whose unimpeded heat would kill it. Mice, rabbits, squirrels, birds, the great reptile devoured them all, stunning them first with sharp jabs of its fangs, then swallowing them slowly and constricting its belly muscles to break down the bones and digest the food. The rattler was a fearsome beast, made more so by frontier legend, most of it spurious. It can't strike at you else in its coiled, needs the spring and power of its coils, then it can reach out twice its length. Coiled, it could strike with remarkable accuracy, uncoiled less so, and never more than half its length. This monster could strike 4 feet, a menacing distance. The snake, he can't never strike you else, and he warns you first with a shake of his rattles. God's recompense, we call it. Most of the time, when hunting small animals, it struck with no warning. But often, at the approach of a man or a large animal, it activated its rattles furiously to scare away the intruder. A rattler is thrifty, carries just enough venom to kill a man. Later experts would demonstrate that whereas 25 milligrams would kill a child and 100 a man, a grown rattler could deliver 250 milligrams, enough to kill 2 men, while a really big snake could inject 1,000 milligrams in one shot. One drop of rattlesnake venom in your bloodstream, you're dead. Many frontiersmen had been struck by medium-sized rattlers and survived. But to be injected with a full charge of venom by a snake as large as this one would be fatal. No man ain't never been struck by a full-sized rattler and lived. A rattler carried only a limited supply of venom in its sacs, and if it had recently discharged this in killing some animal, it could strike its next victim with the full force of its fangs and inflict only a small wound that would quickly heal. Certain boastful men had survived as a result of this phenomenon. This great beast at Quimper's Ferry, longer than any hitherto seen along the Brazos, did not seek contact with human beings. It did its best to avoid them. But if any threatened the quiet of its domain, it could strike with terrifying force. It would not have come into contact with the Quimpers had not Yancey gone probing along the farther bank, not doing any serious work or accomplishing much, but merely poking into holes with a stick to see what might be happening. As he approached where the snake lay hidden, he heard but did not recognize the warning rattle. Thinking it to be a bird or some noisy insect, he probed further and found himself staring at the huge coiled snake not 10 feet away. "Mom!" he screamed. And Mattie, working at the ferry, grabbed the gun she kept aboard for protection against wandering Karankawa and ran to help. But when she reached Yancey, she found him immobilized, pointing at the coiled snake whose rattles echoed. "Do something," he pleaded. Infuriated by his craven behavior and terrified of the snake, she pushed her son aside, and with her heart beating at a rate which must soon cause her to faint, she raised the gun. Not firing blindly, because she knew she had only one chance, she took aim as the snake prepared for its deadly thrust and pulled the trigger. She felt the shock against her shoulder. She felt the snake brush against her knee, and she fainted. Yancey, seeing only that the rattler had struck at his mother and that she had fallen, concluded that the snake had killed her despite the gun blast, and ran screaming up the river to the ferry landing. "Pop, a big rattler killed Mom." Jubal and the Kronk waded and swam across the Brazos, and ran trembling to where Mattie still lay beside the dreadful snake. And when they saw her, they supposed that each had killed the other. "Snake hit her just as she pulled the trigger. Oh, Jesus!" But then the Indian saw her right hand twitch, and when he stepped gingerly past the snake and lifted her head, he saw that she was still breathing. Inspecting her throat and face, he called, "No dead. Scared. Scared." Jubal and Yancey, taking over from the Indian, satisfied themselves that Mattie was indeed alive. And with a love they had not shown before, they carried her upriver to the ferry, where they placed her tenderly aboard. But before they pushed off, the Kronk ran up carrying the enormous snake whose head had been blown apart. "We keep," he said. And the men knew that he intended eating at least part of the fearful enemy out of respect and envy for the courage it had shown. When Jubal tanned the skin, he stretched it to maximum length, extending the accordion-like scales until he had an awesome object that climbed the entire wall of the cabin and back 4 feet along the ceiling, 10 feet, 5 inches in majestic length. Recovering the skull from the Kronk, he attached it so that it appeared to be striking at the diner seated below, and strangers seeing it for the first time said, "They weren't never a snake that big." But Jubal said proudly, "Finger them rattlers yourself. They're real, and my little wife's the one who killed it." Whenever Mattie looked at the fearful object, she thought not of her own heroism in battling the monster, but of her son's behavior. She never spoke of this to the boy's father, and certainly not to the boy himself. But she did often recall her own father's stern admonition to his children when they were living in a Tennessee hovel and subsisting on beans with an occasional slab of pork. "You don't have to fight the world, and you don't have to be the bravest in the village. But by God, if you're my kids, you've got to do what's right when you face danger. I don't care if the other man is twice your size. Go at his throat." Mattie had gone at the great serpent's throat. Her son had not.